from Wayne State in Detroit, and I'm going to talk to you about cardiohepatic interactions and why I think you should know about them and, in fact, what it is. I don't have any disclosures. I'm going to start by reviewing some basic anatomy and physiology. No. Oh, maybe I got to turn it on. Okay, it doesn't matter. And we'll talk about, you know, kind of the key parts of this or the diagnostic considerations when you should be thinking about this. And then also the things that you can do kind of as you leave this lecture when you start seeing patients back in the ED. And now, admittedly, this topic might seem a little bit less applicable to the stuff that we do day to day. And there's probably a little bit of truth to that. This is something that's sort of just starting to crop up in other fields. But I think in the next 3 to 5 years, the stuff I'm talking about today is really going to start to trickle down. We're going to start seeing some of the stuff in the ED. And so that's the whole goal of having this lecture here today. So as this stuff starts to pop up, you can say, aha, I've heard about that. And what we're really thinking about, not just in terms of cardiohepatic interactions, but this idea of moving away from this sort of siloed way that we operate in medicine where there's neurology and there's cardiology and there's GI. Obviously, there's some crosstalk, but we're starting to shift towards a more multimodal approach in the treatment of any particular disease, and the idea is that hopefully we'll be able to improve outcomes. And so, again, this is kind of a new frontier, the next frontier, or that's probably a little bit overstating it, but it lets me use this graphic or this cartoon that I really like because it's two of my favorite TV shows. So what is the cardiohepatic axis? Is it the heart's connected to the liver? Is it the liver's connected to the heart? And, of course, it's both. This figure is really central to the whole talk. It kind of tells you in a nutshell everything you need to know. Of course, there's both diseases that systemically affect the heart and the liver concomitantly, but we often think cardiocentrically, right? So we think when a patient has cardiac dysfunction, we think about the effects that it has on the liver, but what we often don't think about is that in liver disease, there are direct effects on the heart, and I'm going to tell you about some of those today. The basic anatomy is just as a refresher. Remember that the liver has a dual blood supply from the hepatic artery and then the portal system from the splanchnic circulation. Everything circulates down to the sinusoids. And really the key point is that the sinusoid, which is the functional unit of the liver, is a low pressure system, about 7 millimeters of mercury, which is just high enough above right atrial pressure to allow for forward flow. And so even though this is a really low-pressure system, it's actually a really high-volume system because the liver is only about 2%, 2.5% by body weight, but it gets 25% of cardiac output. And so that alone should tell you that it's an important organ. So when you talk about cardiohepatic interactions, there's some sort of arbitrary ways to decide to divide them up, to think about the different cause and effect or how they're linked. And this is just sort of the way I think about it, inflow versus outflow problems, direct versus indirect, and then chronicity. I'm going to talk about each one of these. This is a diagram that shows the different phasicity and pressure that the liver sees across the spectrum of disease. And now in and of itself, this isn't that important, but what is important is to recognize that, you know, the body likes homeostasis. The liver is accustomed to seeing blood flow through it during the cardiac cycle in a certain way. It's accustomed to seeing certain pressures. And so in this first panel, this is normal. So this is the hepatic vein. Flow above the baseline is towards the liver, and flow below the baseline is towards the heart. And so normally you get atrial kick, you get a little flow reversal, and then a systolic and a diastolic component. As pressure builds up in the liver, it gets congested. You get loss of that systolic predominance as it gets even more severe. You get complete systolic reversal. The same is basically true in the portal vein. You see this sort of phasic flow in normal, it becomes more pulsatile as you get more pathologic. Inflow versus outflow problems are pretty easy to understand, right? It's either low cardiac output, LV failure, or RV failure that causes elevated right atrial pressure. Now, obviously, these things are intimately linked. Chronicity, you know, we all know about acute liver failure, right? Hemorrhagic shock, cardiogenic shock, you get acute decreases in blood flow, and you get elevated LFTs, you get ischemia, you get necrosis. We tend to colloquially refer to that as shock liver. The state of chronic congestive hepatopathy is what we're talking about, or what I'm talking about in cardiohepatic interactions. essentially it starts with atrophy at the periphery, then you get central lobular necrosis, then you wind up with hepatic fibrosis, and then in the end, the manifestation that we're familiar with is cholestatic derangements, elevated LFTs, elevated bilirubin. Diagrammatically, again, because I think this is an important point, is just to remember to really not think about acute liver failure is a completely different entity from hemorrhage, from cardiogenic shock, right? That's a acute massive loss of blood inflow, and the liver can't handle that. In chronic congestive hepatopathy, you get a balance between reduced inflow but also reduced outflow that leads to all of the problems. So I've already kind of talked about pressure flow derangements as the direct effects. Indirect, this is something that we don't think about that much, I think, in terms of the liver. You're certainly familiar with these ideas from heart failure, right? Atrial stretch leads to BNP release, which then causes a natriuresis. The same kind of thing happens in the liver. We just don't think about it as much. Obviously, elevated bilirubin, elevated AST, ALT, but there's also a whole slew of other molecules. A lot of them are derived from, or a lot of them are bile acids, which are steroid-derived. They're lipids, they cross cell membranes, they have a whole host of different biological activity. And so again, everything I've kind of just talked about is what happens to the liver when the heart is not very happy. Now I'm going to switch gears and talk about ways in which the liver disease can affect the heart. And you might not actually know or consider that this is really a thing that happens, but this is, if you can believe it, a simplified schematic of some of the ways in which fatty liver disease can have deleterious effects on the heart, changes in lipid metabolism, the redox status, all the different inflammatory markers, genetic changes, hormonal changes. This is just to name a few. The first disease entity is septic cardiomyopathy. Now, you may not have even heard this term. It hasn't been in existence even for that long. It's kind of like regular heart failure in that you can get both systolic and diastolic dysfunction. In overall, what it is you get a chronic vasodilated state and you get a high output cardiac failure that happens kind of slowly. Where this is relevant, this is kind of like one of the first big clinical points I think is important, things you can take back to the ED like tomorrow. Patients come in with bad liver disease. They've got ascites. They're edematous. We think that it's easy to attribute all of that to the fact that they have ascites, right? And we don't often think about the heart. One of the things that probably contributes to this is a lot of common heart failure medications, beta blockers, ACE, ARBs, are contraindicated in liver failure. So, you see this dyspneic patient, you're looking through their med list, you're kind of doing a chart biopsy, you don't see these heart failure medications, and you don't really, so therefore you don't think about it. Why this is so important is because these patients have, depending on where they are in their stage of disease, but they have markedly reduced stress response. They can't elevate their cardiac output in response to something like an infection. And so this is kind of a nice, tidy diagram that tells you the different things, the different stages that a patient goes through. But obviously, humans don't work this way. Like, it's easy to present it this way. But, patient-level heterogeneity is really important. So if you think about, say, a 35-year-old cirrhotic who's been drinking heavily for 15 years, gets a multifocal pneumonia, compared to a 60-year-old who's got diabetes, hypertension, peripheral vascular disease, is a smoker, they get that same multifocal pneumonia, they're going to respond very differently. And so it's important to consider that, again, while knowing some of these different manifestations and the way the disease progresses are important, it's certainly not always fixed in that situation or in that progression. Switching now to fatty liver disease, there's two main types, alcoholic versus non-alcoholic. Obviously, there's a lot of ways in which this can influence cardiac function. A lot of them are sort of structural. It can cause some changes to the valves. It can cause problems with the conduction system. And so there's a whole lot of ways in which this these damages happen. There's obviously all the inflammatory mediators that you've heard all about, that you know all about. Insulin resistance leads to all kinds of problems, glycated hemoglobin problems with fluid balance, et cetera. these patients get this really sort of interesting but really dangerous postprandial hyperlipidemia that leads to ectopic fat deposition, particularly visceral and to some extent epicardial. For reasons that aren't really well understood, this ectopic fat is much more hormonally active than, say, regular fat, and so that's one of the ways that this can be damaging. You can't talk about the liver without talking about the microbiome. Obviously, the enterohepatic circulation, so the gut flora is intimately related to how the liver is functioning. And ultimately, as liver flow gets deranged, the microbiome changes, and so the bacteria are making both different products, more products, and the liver has a differing ability to handle them. One of them that's getting a lot of attention is something called trimethylamine, which is usually pretty easily detoxified and excreted. As you get worsening liver dysfunction, you get buildup of the oxidized version, which has direct cytotoxic effects. There's genetic effects. They're, you know, both things that predispose you to getting fatty liver disease, but also changes in gene expression, protein transcription, things like that. So I already covered this stuff. This is, again, another one of those slides that highlights some of the ways in which this is really clinically important or things that you can take home when you're working in the ED. These patients with fatty liver disease get conditions, they essentially have accelerated atherosclerosis. So you might see a 30-year-old who has fatty liver disease who comes in with stroke symptoms, and you're like, no, that's not a stroke, the guy's too young. So you should consider that these patients may be, you know, 10, 15, 20 years older from a vascular standpoint when you're evaluating them. So what do we do in terms of treatment? Unfortunately, nothing right now. There's a lot of stuff in development, and maybe in 3 or 4 or 5 years, if I give this talk again, I can tell you some more interesting stuff. But for now, we just have to be mindful, think about the concurrent cardiac dysfunction when you see patients with liver dysfunction. The last thing I'm going to kind of move through here is talking about cardiohepatic interactions and sepsis. We know that cardiac dysfunction and sepsis is pretty common. We know patients do worse when they have it. Cholestatic dysfunction, the idea is basically the same. And so you might be saying, like, well, that's like not a very big revelation. We know that patients who are sick tend to do worse, right? But it's actually not that simple. This is a really cool study. And what they found is that patients that have baseline liver dysfunction, but that doesn't worsen during sepsis, actually do better than patients who have either new onset or worsening of their liver failure. This is the survival curve showing that you have an increasing probability of death if you have new or worsening liver failure compared to stable liver failure. Why is this so? The liver does like an inordinate number of tasks. Primarily, again, when we're thinking in sepsis, there's sort of the pro-inflammatory, antibacterial, getting rid of the infection, and then that should hopefully be balanced by the anti-inflammatory effects. If they balance out, everything's happy, the patient recovers. However, if they don't, it doesn't always work out so well. In terms of the functions of the liver that get deranged, you know, there's the synthetic functions, the metabolic issues. If the liver's not functioning well, you may develop toxic metabolites, you may not be able to activate certain drugs, and then the manifestation, again, is jaundice, elevated bilirubin, but again, those are not necessarily that's only a small slice of the molecules, signaling molecules, et cetera, that get released into the circulation that can cause problems. So again, you might be saying, well, like, why do I really care about this? This is maybe like an ICU problem, or I don't know whose problem it is, but it is our problem. This is something that's relevant, and the way it is with fluid resuscitation. We know that, I messed that up, that it was supposed to be for effect when I talked about fluid overload. Well, it's too late now. We know that not enough fluid is bad, and we certainly know that too much fluid is really, really bad. But the problem is, yes, this is really a movie that was actually made. but the problem is we don't actually know who to give how much fluid to and when. But why is fluid resuscitation bad, like on a cellular level? We can all talk about edema and pulmonary edema and this, that, and the other thing. One of the ways in which it's potentially bad is through its disruption of the vascular endothelium. Now, you probably remember with the endothelial cells line the vascular walls, and then there's this sort of soup of proteins and lipids and carbohydrates that kind of hang out. On the luminal side, every organ has a little bit of a different makeup. A lot of the components are the same, but you know, the heart, the liver, the kidney, they're all a little bit different. And so generally the way that this works is, say you're walking down the street, you step on a nail, you get some bacteria and some bleeding up into your heel. You want to recruit a number of things. So for example, you see a white blood cell is kind of minding its own business, but then it's needed, so it translocates across the endothelial border and it kind of goes and it does its thing. There are innumerable ways in which all of the soup of things that are required to respond to infection, to respond to trauma. So this is like a super simplified diagram. But one of the ways that this happens is the endothelium becomes activated. It expresses ligands that then have receptors on the white blood cells. And so you can see, right, white blood cell comes along, binds, and kind of translocates and does its thing. But obviously you want to be able to turn that off at some point. And so, again, using this example, one of the ways that that happens is that these ligands then get cleaved and float around the circulation so that they still bind to the receptor, but then the white blood cell has kind of nowhere in particular to go. So how this is related to IV fluid and how IV fluid can be deleterious, one way that is increasingly becoming recognized has to do with the fact that endothelial cells are flow adapted. They like laminar flow, nice, organized, all going in the same direction. When this gets disrupted, it can cause problems. So for example, say you're like a Neanderthal hanging out in the savanna and you see a saber-toothed tiger and you decide you want to run away. You increase your cardiac output, your respiratory rate, et cetera, but sort of evolutionarily, like you want to be able to select for the people that run the fastest and are the most successful. And one of the ways that you run faster is with vasodilation, right? And so you need to have a way to respond to that stress. And so the increased shear stress, which is shear stress is stresses that are parallel to the vascular wall. So in this situation, the increased shear stress causes vasodilation. It helps you run away. That's a good thing. Loss of shear stress, on the other hand, causes a different sort of reaction. Now, again, say you ate a whole bunch of melons and you were a little bit sleepy, and so that tiger kind of chomped on your ankle a little bit. You're going to have bleeding. You're going to have inoculation of bacteria, tissue damage. And so the way that that is sensed, or one of the ways that's sensed, is by this loss of the shear stress. Again, you're going to recruit platelets. You're going to recruit immune cells. In the short term, that's good, that's beneficial. In the long term, maybe not. And then the last thing, and this is where the fluid resuscitation or over-resuscitation really comes in, which is increase in normal stress. So normal stress is a force that's perpendicular to the vascular wall. and this is pretty easy to sort of visualize. If you blow somebody up with fluid, they're going to get less flow, and since things aren't moving forward, the force vector is going to start to move more towards the vessel wall. There's all kinds of examples of how this causes problems in disease. Even in sort of healthy people, normal people, areas where there's increased normal stress in a normal human would be like large to medium vessel bifurcations. And we also know that these are areas where you get atherosclerosis first. And it's now thought that this change in the normal stress contributes to that. And so again, now you can start to see why fluid overload could potentially disrupt the endothelium and lead to problems. This last little bit I just think is really interesting. You might wonder how these forces get detected. There's something called the mechanosome. This is a really simplified cartoon, but there's these cell surface molecules that then detect the changes in stress that then cause signal transduction, leading to release of nitric oxide, causes the vasodilation. But it's not just this one cell. These cell-cell adhesion molecules actually communicate, and so the cells adjacent to this cell also get activated. There are many, 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 many more ways in which changes in the mechanical forces experienced by cells in the endothelium can alter inflammation. And again, some of these things can be really good in the short term, but if you get overactivation, they can certainly be bad. The other thing that's now becoming recognized is, you know, TNF-alpha and TGF-beta. You probably remember this stuff from medical school that play a role in infection and response to sepsis. All of this stuff combines to cause some problems. this is sort of a mishmash diagram that shows all of the different, or many of the different ways in which this happens. I talked a little bit before about how there's a little bit of variation organ to organ. This has been studied extensively, like in lung transplant, and they found that there's a lot of early rejection. And what they've discovered, what they really think is happening, is that loss of shear stress when you get the donor lung leads to these changes in the mechanical, right? The mechanical forces change. You get this overwhelming oxidative stress that then causes fibrosis in like the end capillaries. And you remember, like around the alveoli, they're basically one red blood cell thick. And so they get fibrosed, and then the lung no longer works, and then the transplant fails. So overall, to kind of sum up, a congested liver is an unhappy liver. We think of the typical cholestatic derangements, bilirubin, LFTs, as sort of the indicators of those. But it's important to remember that these are probably not the actual effector molecules that are causing problems, bile acids, a number of other things. I mention this because I think at some point this kind of stuff is coming down the road, and so it's useful for you to know about it. So how much is enough? It's really hard to say, right? I think there's patient-level heterogeneity, and there's going to be patient-level factors that are going to dictate who needs what when. How are we going to assess this? This is really like the million-dollar question. Some people are kind of looking at this with ultrasound, but I'm an ultrasound person myself, and I recognize that you don't want to do an ultrasound on every person, especially repeatedly. Truth be told, I don't really want to ultrasound every septic person over and over again. Hopefully, you know, as this develops, you know, ultrasound may be a part of it. There's a lot of AI technology that's coming along that is certainly going to make the obtaining information much easier and much more efficient. So it might just be, you know, you put the probe on the patient and the machine does all the calculations. The other thing along with that is biomarkers. So, right, as the endothelium gets damaged, it releases a whole bunch of things into the circulation. So there are studies underway to try to identify some of these biomarkers and try to put it all together. But it's definitely more complicated than just saying, lots of fluids, not that many fluids. I don't know, you guys might have heard this, or you might not have, the Clovers trial, which was early vasopressors versus fluid liberal resuscitation randomized trial from NIH. Actually just got stopped a couple weeks ago for futility. And if you, maybe you can see how, you know, thinking about some of this stuff, why that's actually probably not that big of a surprise, is because there's just so many patient level differences that it's not going to work, just sort of a blind randomization. But in any case, remember that heart disease and liver disease coexist, especially a patient who comes in with liver disease, and remember that they have very low reserve to respond to infection, trauma, bleeding, et cetera, et cetera. The deleterious effects are synergistic. You remember I showed you that diagram. Actually, I think I have it again. It can become a self-reinforcing cycle, and I think it's really incumbent upon us to know about this and to think about it when we're treating patients. Unfortunately, we don't have any target therapeutics at this point, but I think in the next, you know, 5 to 10 years, this is something that we're going to start hearing about and thinking about. So you heard it here, and so hopefully it won't be too much of a shock. And with that, I'm going to wrap up, and I'll take questions. Oh, on the endothelial cell.
Yeah.
It's all the endothelium. No, that's real. It's a family of enzymes. I don't know. I guess scientists are not as like super creative, but you know, it's a family of enzymes that cleaves the ligands, and they're called shedases. But I'm glad you were paying attention. Anyone else?
Because he was your former fellow and has to take it.
Yeah, yeah. I think that was like a stipulation in the contract. Questions about zombie tidal wave, Star Trek, Beavis and Butthead. I could talk ad infinitum about those. But okay. All right. Thank you, guys.